Good afternoon, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the Dialogue Forum of the 10th anniversary of the Sirach Lincoln Lectureship Series. The lectureship was inaugurated in 1983 and named in honor of the Reverend Dr. Professor Sirach Lincoln, a former chair of the Department of Religion and Philosophy and administrator at Clark College, now Clark Atlanta University. Dr. Lincoln is internationally recognized as an authority on the sociology of black religion, race, and ethnic relations in the United States. He has written or edited more than 20 books and has published more than 100 articles. His most recent publications are The Black Church in the African American Experience and This Land Since Freedom. His first novel, The Avenue Clayton City, published in 1988, received the William Smith Award for the best piece of Southern fiction by a Southern writer and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Dr. Lincoln is currently the William Rand Keenan Professor of Religion and Culture at Duke University. Dr. Lincoln, we welcome you to this forum.
Thank you.
Dr. Lincoln, the sociologist, will be joined by a world-class theologian, Dr. Jacqueline Grant, and historian, Dr. John Hope Franklin, the 1992 Sirach Lincoln lecturer. Dr. Grant is a professor of systematic theology at the Interdenominational Theological Center here in the AU Center. She has become one of the nation's most prominent theologians and advocates for black women's rights in the church and in society in general. She is a graduate of Bennett College. She's a graduate of the Interdenominational Theological Center, and she holds a PhD degree from Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Dr. Grant has published numerous articles, and her most recent book is entitled White Women's Christ and Black Women's Jesus. She has taught at Harvard Divinity School, Candler School of Theology, and Princeton Theological Seminary. Dr. Grant has traveled extensively throughout America and other countries in Africa, Asia, South America, and Europe, and she has been featured in Ebony Magazine as one of the 10 women to watch. Dr. Grant, we welcome you to this forum. Our third panelist is none other than the renowned and eminent scholar, John Hope Franklin, a leading American historian and a noted historian of the American South. He's a graduate of Fisk and earned the master's and PhD degrees from Harvard. This Phi Beta Kappa is the author of more than 100 short articles and 11 books, including a biography of George Washington Williams, which is the theme of this year's lecture. Prior to accepting the distinguished James B. Duke Professor of History at Duke University, Dr. Franklin taught at Fisk University, North Carolina Central, Brooklyn College, Chicago University. Among his most notable contributions is his membership in the research team whose work led to the 1954 landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education, which outlawed school segregation. He also participated in the historic 1965 march from Selma to Montgomery, which pressured the government into the enactment of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Dr. Franklin, we welcome you to this forum. The forum will proceed according to the following format. The first questions will be in the field of the respective disciplines of the panelists. The second portion of the dialogue will be a general question, and each panelist will be asked to respond from their respective discipline. Following my questions, students representing honors courses in history, philosophy, and religion will address, ask questions to the panelists, and also there will be opportunity for the audience to address questions to the panelists. As you know, the theme of the 10th anniversary of the Searing Lincoln Lecture focuses on George Washington Williams. And as a matter of fact, I think I'm correct in this, on tomorrow will be his birthday. It would have been his birthday, and he would have been 143 years of age if he was still with us, because he was born 1849, October the 16th. I will begin my questions with Dr. Franklin. Dr. Franklin, I discovered from the introduction of your biography of George Washington Williams that your initial acquaintance with the Williams was when you were preparing to write your most celebrated work, From Slavery to Freedom. The question I want to ask is this: what factors and forces obscured the works of George Washington Williams?
Well, Williams died in 1891. We observed the centennial of his passing just a year ago. In the first place, Williams moved about a great deal, and therefore it would have been difficult under the most favorable circumstances for him to have accumulated and kept together anything resembling a record of his actions and activities. Perhaps more important than that is that Williams was born into a period and died in a period when there was no interest in or desire to perpetuate what African Americans had done or would do. And so in a manner of speaking, I think figuratively we can say that this country turned its back on George Washington Williams. Dying as he did in 1891, that's the year after the Mississippi legislature met to disfranchise African Americans. And that whole decade is a period of degradation, I would say, of African Americans. It was in 1896 that the very important decision of Plessy against Ferguson was handed down, in which the Supreme Court made no uncertain point. It left no doubt but that the United States Constitution did not protect African Americans in their right to travel unmolested and without discrimination or segregation. In other words, the climate in which he lived and died was a climate that was of unusual hostility to African Americans. Meanwhile, there was a whole so-called scientific approach to this problem, namely that blacks were not capable of performing the highest duties of citizenship or of civilization. This country had never yet accepted the fact that blacks were free, that they were equal human beings, and that they had rights protected under the Constitution. Under those circumstances, you see, it's a wonder that his name even lasted, say nothing of a reputation or any account of his activities. So that's what one would have to go up against in trying to find out who George Washington Williams was, why he lived, what he did, and all the rest of it.
Thank you. Well, the second part of the question is that, as you know, there were other writers such as William C. Nails and William Wells Brown, who also made serious attempts at recording black history. But what I want to know is, what were the distinguishing characteristics of George Washington Williams' writings, and that he got the notoriety, it seemed, as the historian rather than William Wells Brown and some of the others?
Well, in the first place, William C. Nell attempted to popularize the history of African Americans. He wrote two or three works. One had to do with the services of black Americans in the War for Independence. Another had to do with their work during the War of 1812 and subsequent conflicts, skirmishes, and so forth. And William Wells Brown was not only a, writer, not only a historian of sorts, but also gave a good deal of attention to fictional work as well as nonfiction. So that these men were, I would say, eclectic, moving about, looking at different things, and without any serious training in the field of historical studies. Now, George Washington Williams fancied himself a careful student of history. I've looked at the curriculum that he went through at the Newton Theological Institution between 1870 and 74 when he was there, and he did take historical courses. I've also been fortunate enough to find out what he read when he was in the legislature in Ohio, and what books he got out of the state library, and they were books primarily of history. So what he hadn't learned formally, he had taught himself informally, so that he was much better prepared than the historians, would-be historians of an earlier period like Nell and Brown. In addition to that, the whole movement for making history much more accurate and scientific was very much a part of the life of Williams. And despite the fact he did not go to graduate school in history and so forth, he realized what was going on. His correspondence is clearly that. For example, he had a very extensive correspondence with George Bancroft, who was the outstanding historian of the last half of the 19th century, and he knew what was going on in historical circles. He sought to join the American Historical Association, and although I have not been able to establish categorically that he did become a member, he was very much interested in the membership. In other words, he associated himself with the movement to make history more accurate, more scientific, and so forth, so that he would seek to emulate the so-called scientific historians as much as possible. I make the statement deliberately, call them so-called, because these historians who call themselves scientific historians were full of prejudices and senses of feelings about other people that would make them clearly unscientific.
Thank you for that insight. Dr. Grant, from a theological perspective, I would like to ask you this question. What is your theological critique of the lifestyle and the ministry of George Washington Williams from a womanist theological position?
Well, it's interesting. I find Williams to be very a very fascinating person, or perhaps I find the way he is presented by John Hope Franklin to be very fascinating. He does make the character become alive for us even today. It's really interesting, as you give an account of the life of Williams, there does seem to be, and you did indicate in the presentation, that there does seem to be some restlessness. There was some restlessness about his lifestyle, the movement from one area to another, geographically and also occupationally. But it's interesting that I'm interested in some further exploration as to how they all connected. For example, one of the points that was made earlier this morning was that Williams left the ministry, or left a theology. I don't recall exactly how the statement was made.
Ministry.
The ministry, okay. I would be interested in knowing, in further exploring, for example, did he really leave the ministry, or did was there a broadening of his understanding of ministry in the sense of being able to see the interconnectedness of the various occupations of life? For example, there's a sense in which one can see a movement from ministry, and not a movement from ministry, but a broadening from a narrow perspective or narrow understanding of ministry to a greater understanding of the impact of ministry on life. And how do you really explore the impact of ministry on life without understanding the people to whom one ministers, with whom one ministers? So I would be interested in knowing, for example, is there a connection between the movement from the ministry or the movement in the ministry to the interest in politics, for example, or the interest in law, particularly in terms of how law historically in a racist country negatively impact African-American peoples, and the interest in ministry, law, and also the interest in history then. How do you adequately minister to people if you don't understand the history of the people to whom you minister or with whom you minister? And so I was fascinated really with the subject, and very much interested in see how we can look at him holistically and not just a matter of being restless in this occupation and moving to another, but how you look at it holistically. As a womanist theologian, I see as my primary task attempting to develop a holistic understanding of reality so that we see ourselves not as separate entities or in terms of separate entities, but the interconnectedness of reality. How do I connect my being female with my being African-American and with my being a part of the human race? How do I connect what it means to be all of those parts? How do I totally understand the being of an African-American woman? So that it seems to me that there may be some merit in attempting to discover some interconnectedness in the life, in addition to seeing it as moving from one phase to another, but how those phases connected with each other. Certainly as a woman theologian, as a liberation theologian, I would be interested in seeing how if there was a growth in really his understanding of religion and what's really the meat of religion. How do you really arrive at an adequate understanding of religion?
I think that that's a very interesting observation. And perhaps even what you say give me the opportunity to view Williams a little differently. For example, when he was still the pastor of the 12th Baptist Church in Boston, one of the things he thought ought to be done was to write a history of that church and to see if he could make a connection between the earlier, the founders of that church and the great distinguished minister who preceded him, Leonard Grimes, with the present, and would that have a message to deliver to his members at that time? And I think he saw that this was a role that history could play. When he went to Cincinnati and became the pastor of a Union Baptist Church there, it wasn't enough for Williams to reach his parishioners on Sunday morning or anything like that. What he did was to set up, instead of prayer meeting on Wednesday night, he set up a series of lectures. And he gave lectures on Wednesday nights for months. He would announce what he was going to talk about. Sometimes he would have guests, but he had plenty to talk about himself without having guests. And that did take the place of a traditional type of activity in the church in the middle of the week. That didn't set well with everyone, and of course it was somewhat unorthodox, they thought. But he stuck to that. Then there were other ways in which he sought to reach a larger audience through his lectures and his newspaper columns and so forth, some of which did deal with religious questions. I would not be altogether honest, though, if I gave him credit for broadening his religious message, as it were, in this way. It's very interesting to observe that the more he got involved in other things, the less religious he became, or the more secular he became. And I would very much doubt that, say, by the time he publishes the History of the Negro People in 1882, I would doubt that he's very much that he sees history. I mean, he sees the ministry holistically, as you suggested. I think he's become something of a, if you forgive me, a crass realist, a materialist. A person who is very much interested in creature comforts, and who is drifting away from, let me use a very popular term, family values, and is really not very much. But indeed, I'm not. I don't. If perhaps this isn't required, Jacqueline, but if he's supposed to be church-going, to have continue a connection, he even isn't that very much by 1884-5. So I don't think that that we can be too sympathetic or too charitable in the last decades of his life. I think he's drifting, and he's drifted away from the moorings, and I think he's very secular. I think he's very materialistic. He's very worldly, if I may say so, by this time. He has almost everywhere he stops, he has a girlfriend. He makes a trip across the Atlantic, and before he can land at the European port, there are messages coming back to the United States about the girls he was with on the ship going over. You know, it's just he's very sort of, shall we say, speedy, sort of quick. And I it's very interesting to observe that in his criticisms of King Leopold, for the way in which he was running the Congo, Williams deals with this conduct of his of Leopold's not in a high ethical or moral terms, but in terms of his being a beast and human and so forth, which is enough. I mean, it's certainly graphic enough, but there is no invocation of a larger religious, spiritual force here. He's just a no-good person. that is Leopold. So I would think he was really drifting away from the religious and spiritual moorings of an earlier time. It would be, I think I would be unfair to my 40 years of studying Williams if I didn't say he was essentially an opportunist. Sometimes it was religion that fit, but sometimes it was something else. The something else was all right. And in addition to being an opportunist, I think he was just a bit dishonest, which we usually think of as being immoral. If someone said that he went to Harvard University, he wouldn't correct them. He was at Howard University for about 6 months, you see. But if you wanted to call that Harvard, it was all right with him.
Thank you very much. Very interesting and enlightening. Dr. Lincoln, from a sociological perspective, I would like to ask you this question. Does George Washington Williams, in any sense, reflect the major themes in your excellent work that I enjoy reading so much, Race, Religion, and the Continuing American Dilemma?
Well, I'd like to look at George Weston Williams through another lens, through another refraction, and perhaps the answer to your question will come out there. I think, first of all, we must see Williams in the setting that produced him. Williams was the child of a Slovakracy. Williams was a man of African descent. At the time that he was born, and indeed during his whole life, he was a person about whom there was continued conjecture as to whether he was human or whether he wasn't, whether he could learn or whether he couldn't, whether he was three-fifths human or whatever. There were millions of people like Williams in the sense that they found it necessary to test the bounds of their freedom, to test the reality of their freedom. Seems to me that if you are trying to understand why Williams did so many things, why he went so many places, why he got himself involved in so many different kinds of activities, I think a part of the answer may lie in the fact that he is testing not only his freedom, but he is also testing his ability. He tests his intellectuality by wanting to become a historian, even though he was illiterate. He tests the bounds of reality by wanting to become a minister. He didn't know any theology, but he decided to learn some. He tests his manhood by being a soldier. He's not satisfied to be a soldier in one war. He has to go into two wars to be a soldier. He tests his political ability by being a politician. Here is a man who wants to discover, what am I really? What are the bounds? What are the limitations? I've been told all my life that I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do the other. Is it true? Is it true? Or can I do what any other human being can do? So he does all of these various things to test the bounds of his limitations, to test the bounds of the reality into which he has suddenly been loosed. And I think that the ultimate test for that, for him and for his times, was his transracial alliances. If you can do that, if you can do that, then you can pass any kind of scrutiny, any kind of test. And it seems that Williams did it with a will and with a vim and a vigor. He, Dr. Franklin says, he can't take ship but when he finds a new girl. And he has new girls in every port, and he has girls who are white, girls who are black. And all of this helps him test the bounds of the reality in which he finds himself. I see underneath all of the rascality that may be involved, a man who not only had a great deal of native ability, but who also developed a great deal of belief in himself at a time when that kind of possibility was certainly not to be taken for granted. So I see Williams as being a person somewhat born out of time, not altogether different, if you will, from W.E.B. Du Bois. W.E.B. Du Bois, born in Massachusetts, goes to Fisk, ends up at Harvard and at Heidelberg, and still has the problem of trying to determine who he is. Who am I? He still has the problem of this double identity. No wonder he has a problem of double identity, because what he learned as a black man in Massachusetts was somewhat different from what he learned as a black man in Atlanta or in Tennessee, and what he learned as a black man in Heidelberg had no relationship to anything. So how does he know? How does he know who he is? The only way that he can find out is to test it by his works, by his books, by his writings, by his relationships. And in the case of Du Bois, it was never quite clear, because he dies in Africa after having found that all of the things that he thought he was were rejected in his own country. Could this be the reason why Williams is wandering the earth, wandering the globe, why he ends up in some English town? What is he looking for? I think he was looking for himself.
It's really remarkable that, as you, that there are these comparisons, similarities indeed, between Williams and Du Bois. I think Williams was a seeker. I didn't want to deny that at any point. He had different ways of showing it from what Du Bois did, and yet there they are. Yes, surely. I think there came a point in Williams' life when he could no longer bear this country, I think for different reasons. Largely his were personal. He was attacked bitterly, not merely by a considerable segment of the white community, but by his own people. He was attacked as having been unethical in his legislative activities in Ohio. He was attacked for his political activities, and particularly in his relationship with various white people, including Fleischman, who was the founder of the yeast fortune. He was attacked for his social relationships with various groups of black people. And then he was attacked because he was seeking to establish a historical society and various other groups that would redound to the benefit of, he thought, his race, but most people thought he was just a self-aggrandizer. And he does leave. He leaves this country because he says, you know, there's nothing here for me. I haven't found, despite the fact that I've done all these things, I haven't found myself, I haven't found my niche. And then he goes to Africa, as Du Bois does. And it's only because he has some temporary relief, health-wise, that he gets out of Africa. Otherwise, he would have died in Africa and probably been buried there. He was very ill in Cairo in the early spring of 1891, but he finally made it back to England. But he didn't ever get back to this country. And I don't think he had much of a will to get back to this country. And he died there, and it happens to be buried in Blackpool. But I hadn't thought of the striking similarities, Eric, until you had mentioned them. Despite the fact that I've been to Accra, I've been to the grave of Du Bois, I had a trip there when I was pursuing Williams in Kinshasa, in Zaire, where he had been. But there's a really striking similarity. The seekers searching for themselves and for the grail of whatever it was. It's an amazing coincidence.
One more comment, if I may. You mentioned the fact that he was severely criticized by both white and black. It's obvious that wanting to do the things that he wanted to do, he's got to be criticized by white people, because those were not things that were thought to be proper even for black people to attempt or to think about. So he's got to be criticized by white people. Again, we must look at the history out of which he comes, where that all of the conventional perspectives are also set by people. You're talking about people who are not a full generation out of slavery. Where are they going to get their values? If the white man criticizes you, then I'm certainly going to criticize you, because the only people we have ever been taught to be right are people who are white. So this is not to let Williams off the hook for whatever he may have done that was not kosher, but that's not the point. The point is that at that time, as at this time, too many people derive their values secondhand. Too many people derive their values secondhand. So I would have to look closely at Williams for myself to see whether or not he deserved the kind of press that he got. And one final thing. You mentioned the possibility of self-aggrandizement, and certainly there seems to be ample opportunity for that to have taken place. But I would warn you that the line between self-confidence and self-aggrandizement is very, very faint.
All right. I'm going to leave that alone. I'm going to forego my general question, because my role is to facilitate this and not to monopolize it. That being the case, I'm going to ask our honor students who have prepared questions, if they will come to the mic. Lisa Jones, Patty Hammond, Sinitra Bates, and Greg Comedy. That's Lisa Jones, please, excuse me. If they would come, these students who have prepared questions, they'll only have a chance to ask one question to the panelists of their choice. And as they are coming, we opposed this to the students. We said to them, if you have the chance of a lifetime to ask some of the most renowned scholars in the world one question, what would that be? That's a dream. And today that dream has come true with the panelists that we have before us, and we're going to ask them to come whatever order they would like and ask the question that they are prepared. And we trust that the audience will be thinking of questions. We will not be able to take a whole lot of questions from the audience, but we will be able, hopefully, to take a few questions, because we do have another activity across the street at Soul Source Bookstore. Thank you so much. Sinitra?
Good afternoon. My name is Sinitra Bates, and I'm a senior religion and philosophy / art student here at Clark Atlanta University. Let me first begin by extending a warm welcome and thanks and appreciation for both Dr. Lincoln and Dr. Franklin for coming and joining us at this time. Never in my academic career have I been so excited and anxious to learn about history, particularly African-American history. And I guess I could place some of the blame on the level of emphasis that was placed upon it by my earlier schooling, and also the quality of textbooks that were available. And what I would like for each of you to do is to expound on the importance of knowing that history and the necessity of writing books such as both of you have, as far as African Americans are concerned.
Thank you.
Well, I yield to the historian automatically.
I defer to the distinguished historian sociologist automatically.
If I might. Okay.
Well, first of all, I think that if you are going to have any sense of self at all, you must have a sense of history. And that is why I think that one of the great gifts to African Americans, indeed one of the great gifts to the American people has been John O. Franklin, because he has helped two or three generations of people, black, white, and otherwise, to look at themselves from the perspectives of history and to get new ideas about who they are and about what their possibilities are. When you were told, or certainly when we were told, that, quote, you have no history, unquote, what we were really being told is that you don't exist. And if you don't exist, then there are no possibilities for you tomorrow. And so this meant, in some instances, that we had to go out and try to invent a history. But we didn't need to invent a history. There was one already there. We only needed to discover it. And this is what John has helped us do. We only needed to discover the history that was there, to put it together, and to see ourselves in that perspective. We do have a history. We have a very important history. And because we have a history that we understand, we also have a future.
Thank you. Dr. Grant?
I'd like to respond to that question from a theologian, though it was asked a sociologist and a historian.
Yeah. Please.
Theology is a discipline which is done by human beings. God does not do theology, human beings do. And therefore, we do theology out of a context, out of a sociopolitical, historical context, and it therefore becomes important to understand that context in order to do what I might call good theology, certainly adequate theology. As an African-American woman theologian attempting to carve new grounds in the discipline of theology by, at this time, developing a new perspective called womanist theology, one of the serious handicaps that I have as a theologian is that we do not have adequate African-American women historians. To do the kind of historical work that needs to be done in order that a theologian can do the work that he or she needs to do based on the history. As Dr. Franklin was lecturing this morning, I just kept thinking of the pervasive need for African-American women to do those kinds of historical studies on persons like Jerina Lee, for example, whose picture is behind me, or other African-American women of history that we have not known adequately about. We hear about a few exceptions, but we have not begun to tap the wealth of resources that exist in our own history. And so as a theologian, I'm handicapped because there are not adequate number of historians and African-American women historians who are interpreting African-American women's history in order to provide the kind of data that I need to do my work as a historian. I recall one of my colleagues, who's a sociologist, interested in doing work on AME women preachers or empowerment in the church, a sociological study, ended up having to assume the role of a historian to do much of historical research before she can go and do her sociological analysis of the historical realities. So that it becomes important then. I, as a theologian, I would like not to have to become a historian because I don't have the skills. I don't have the wherewithal to do the kind of historical analysis that was represented in the presentation this morning, but that I need to do my work. And so that merely represents a pitch to you as college students that indeed we do need more African-American women in the various disciplines to do the kind of research that we need done, but we do need historians and church historians as well.
Thank you. I mentioned textbooks because of the books that have been written and the importance of those textbooks written by us as college students and when we began, you know, our other careers and everything. So I just wanted someone to expound on that as well, is that the importance of writing and the importance of keeping these things down.
You know, when I was a student in college, and in graduate school, I didn't have any African-American history, not any. And I wasn't jesting this morning when I said I taught myself what I know. And I heard someone say that's not much, but that's all right. I can live with that. So we, in a certain generation, taught ourselves. Then there was the effort made in the 1960s and 70s to broaden the opportunities. After some books had been written and so forth, I'd written From Slavery to Freedom, so broaden the opportunities. I remember in one instance, and by this time large numbers of African Americans are going to predominantly white institutions, and they are now wanting these institutions to broaden their curriculums to include materials on African American history. And one proposal at one institution, remain nameless, is that we would like a semester of African American history. And the dean, in some seriousness, I won't say all seriousness, but the dean said, well, but what are you going to do with the entire semester? That is, after you get through with your African American history, how are you going to fill out the semester? You see, we had to go through that period. First, no African Americans. Then, people were saying, "Well, yes, you can have some, but my goodness, what are you asking for? A whole semester of it?" Then we finally got through that, and here we are at a time when I think the literature in the field, whether it's really talking about history as such, or literature itself, or sociology, is expanding, is growing, and there are fairly considerable number of women historians, as you know, Jacqueline, who are working in African-American women's religious history. So the time will come, I think, when the literature will be adequate. But this, to write it, record it, to publish it is one thing. To get it to the point where people will regard it as credible or respectable or adequate is quite something else. It's quite something else. And don't you make any mistake about it. There are people now who are so deeply ingrained in their thinking about what African Americans are not, or what they have not done, Eric, or what they can't do, that they can't bring themselves. The power structure in this country is not black. And as long as the power structure is as it is as ignorant as it is about blacks, it's going to remain as it is. So they need teaching. They need as much as we do. I don't want it to go to the other extreme. I was out at the University of Washington some years ago, and they had a big battle to get black history into the university, and they finally had. Then I went to lecture at this class, and there were 200 or 300 whites in there, 2 blacks. The other blacks were all outside. They didn't need to come. They had their history. They knew their history. I don't know how they got it, by osmosis or something, but they had it. So we don't need to go that far. That is, seeing to it that the whites get it and the blacks don't. But we all need to have it. If this country is going to be turned around, it needs to be turned around. If this country is going to be turned around at all, at least in this area, it's going to be on the basis of some understanding of this. And it means that we need also not to view African American history in a vacuum, mm-hmm. but as a part of American history, as a part of American history. You know, don't let anyone let you think that if you have some course on black heroes and you're enjoying that, that you're getting anywhere in terms of the impact of the history of African Americans in this country. There is not a day in the history of the United States from 1619 to the present where blacks are not a part of the history of this country.
of the entire country. And don't let them let you go over in some little Jim Crow corner with two or three heroes and heroines and think that you can have a good time, enjoy yourself, because you've got your heroes. No, that won't work. You must get to the point where you must make them understand that if they don't study the history of the Revolution and have the blacks in there who kept them straight during the Revolution, that that the history of this country will remain as flawed as Thurgood Marshall said that it was, and that Clarence Thomas attacked him for saying it was.
Lisa Jones, yes.
Hi, my name is Lisa Jones, and I'm currently a senior here at Clark Atlanta University, and I have a double major, political science and philosophy. And my question is, should we as African Americans claim Africa as our home? And if we do, how would we integrate their culture into ours here in America?
I defer.
Whoever. Jacqueline?
I'm not sure I got the question.
She said the question was, would you restate it, please?
Okay, should we claim, as African Americans, should we claim Africa as our home? And if we do, how would we, you know, integrate their cultures into our system here? How we've been brainwashed and, you know, what we think?
I think there are several answers to that. And it depends a great deal upon what you mean by home and whether or not you are equating home, quote unquote, with culture, quote unquote. I'm fond of telling a story of a visit that I made to Africa many years ago. I was head of a firm that was flying plane loads of people from America to Africa to, quote, rediscover their roots. And this was in the early 70s. And on the very first plane load, we had a young African-American out of Chicago who had on his dashiki. He had his Afro haircut. He had the lion tooth necklace around his neck, and he had the bracelets on his arms and so on. And as soon as the plane touched down in Accra, he leaped out and knelt down on the tarmac and kissed the ground. And he said, "Ah, home at last." And a group of African students who had come to meet the plane, one of them tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Oh, you've been here before?" Now, I think that it is very important that everyone have a sense of heritage. I think that's extremely important in a culture such as this, where people are very fond of referring to the people in the old country and so on, as if this gives them a sense of continuity, a sense of identity. If that is what you are looking for, and I think that is important, then we also have a sense of continuity, we have a sense of identity. We are, perhaps among other things, African. African. And I think that this ought to be a part of our identity until we are so certain of our identity that we may or may not need it. But I am African. Africa, my Africa, at last I come to thee. O land of mystic fame across the Stygian Sea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm out of Africa, so to speak. I'm proud of Africa. I'm going to wear the kente cloth stole and so on. I need to do this. I need to do this because I need to feel that I'm not just carved out of the air. That I have some roots, that I have a culture, and that I can identify. We have problems because of the fact that we are not often able to be specific about our African cultures, our African heritages, and so on. I have a very close friend in Ghana whose name happens to also be Eric. We were walking across the campus of the University of Ghana one day. He says, "Oh, Eric," he says, "I feel so frustrated because I don't know who you are." And what he meant was, "I don't know your tribal relationship, and you don't either." And he says, "I love you, but I don't know who you are." And what we have to do in such a case is to make for ourselves, or to take for ourselves, a collective heritage. It's enough that I am African, even though I'm not certain as to whether I'm a Shanti. I think I am, but I may indeed be Yoruba, Igbo, or whatever. But yes,
Kikuyu.
I'm sorry.
I just say, "Oh, Kikuyu."
Yeah. Who can say? But I think we need that backup.
Thank you.
I'd like to respond to that.
Yes.
Briefly. I think that the challenge for us, particularly those conscious progressive folks who are interested in, who understand the importance of making that hookup, I think the challenge for us really is one of educating the general populace to be able to see Africa, our home, through our own eyes, as opposed to through the eyes of our oppressors. I will never forget a colleague of mine, an African woman who was in the States working on a doctoral degree in religious studies, and she was telling about her experience working with the local church, planning a trip to Africa, and the phenomenal experience that she had trying to get the people who were interested in going beyond the question, "Are there any hotels in Africa?" obviously, we still suffer under some very negative, inadequate imageries that come from our oppressors that give us a reflection of a Tarzan Africa that, unfortunately, we still labor under today. One of the very first questions a young man asked me, about a 14-year-old boy asked me when I made my first trip to Africa was, "Did you see any lions?" That was his first question. "Did I see any lions?" Well, why not did I see any people, you know? So I think that there's a challenge for us in terms of educating the general populace about Africa. What is Africa, and in what ways are we African people?
Dr. Franklin? I want to associate myself with these two comments and perhaps add this observation. I think that there is certainly a great heritage that we ought to cherish, we ought to preserve, we ought to cling to, but we ought to know what it is. It isn't lions. It isn't elephants. It isn't all of that. So much as it is a spirit, and a culture, to the extent that we can understand and appreciate the culture. It isn't artificial. It doesn't have to be artificial. It doesn't have to be superficial. It doesn't have to be the language. There are a number of people who you know, the big deal back in the 60s was Swahili. Well, they found out that was a little hard, you know. It just didn't come just by registering in the course, you know. So you don't have to go that far. You don't even have to have a dashiki unless you want it, but you can have an understanding of the great spirit of Africa, the wonders of Africa, the genealogy of Africa, the fact that that's where civilization began, you see, that's where the human being began, you see, and that all these savages and things around up in these other places, you know, they finally came to heel, so to speak. And this gives you a sense of self, sense of self-esteem, sense of knowing who you are, and that sort of thing. It seems to me that's important. A homeland. I call the first chapter in my book, now that I've been trained to be, not to be a sexist, called Land of Our Ancestors. I don't say Land of Our Fathers anymore. Land of Our Ancestors. Yes, the Land of Our Ancestors. Now, you cannot do with that the same thing that a first or second generation Italian does. There's no need of your trying to do it, because then you'll stump your toe, you see. You don't know the language, you don't know the diet, all the rest of it. But you can learn as much as you can or wish to. And I do whatever I can. I have a young man living in, I always have young men, young women living in our home. We just like to do that. No expenses at all, nothing, just be there. Eat all you want and that sort of thing. Now this young man had been a fellow in Africa last year. He comes back, he eats no pork anymore. He can't have pork. Hard times as well as good times.
Thank you.
Very good.
Our next question from Patty Hammond.
Hello, my name is Patty Hammond, and I'm a senior here at Clark Atlanta University, and my major is sociology. My question is concerning our youth. As I do some volunteer work back in Kansas City, that's where I'm from, at the Juvenile Justice Center, and I also spent some time here in the Atlanta Juvenile Justice Center. And my question is that a lot of our young people seems as they think that institutions such as the educational system, the institution of religion, the press, their families have, I guess, forsaken them in a sense. But, and I was wondering to myself, how is it or how can I convince these young people who, and oftentimes their parents got them selling drugs or they're products of the situation that they're in, how can I convince them that that's not the answer, whether it be drugs, whether it be whatever the thing that they're engaged in. How can I convince, as an aspiring sociologist or a future social scientist, what can I say to these young people that the solutions that they're seeking are counterfeit solutions and that they need concrete solutions to deal with the problems in their life? And Dr. Lincoln, you mentioned that George Washington Williams, he was testing his boundaries. He tested politics and he tested and religion. It seems that a lot of our, specifically, we have a lot of George Washington Williams in our community. Our black men are testing different things. They're testing crack. They're testing all type of things. What can we do as aspiring educators to guide this negative energy? Because it's a lot of testing going on, a whole bunch of testing. So what can we do to maybe provide answers and concrete solutions to our young people? Because I don't like the things that they're testing right now.
One of the things you can do is to point out that you don't have to test cyanide. It's already been tested. The community, the society, is always going to contain hazards. They are always going to be risks to living. That was not the kind of testing that I had in mind, but there are always going to be risks. The quotient of success that we adults, we educators, we parents have is measured in terms of how we teach our children to deal with the risk. It used to be that we could say to them, don't do as I do, do as I say do, and that would work. That doesn't work anymore. The contemporary child does as he sees you do. And so that means that he has to take the same risk over and over and over and over again, which is a way of saying that if you don't read history or you don't believe history, you have to live it for yourself. And living it for yourself, you may not live very long. That's only a part of the problem, though. I think that the problem is much, much bigger than that. We live in a chemically oriented society. It isn't merely a matter of taking crack. It isn't merely a matter of taking heroin. But it's a matter of being a part of a society which goes to its mouth or goes to its arm under the slightest pressures of any sort. So it begins with taking an aspirin, and you end up taking crack. Now, that isn't as silly as it sounds. It simply says that we have come to rely upon chemicals to rid us of all our ills. That's the new way of being rid of whatever it is that bothers you. There was a time when you could pray and get rid of it, but now you don't pray anymore, you take a drug. Now, obviously, that puts a new kind of responsibility on the shoulders of those of us who have managed to get through the morass without sinking in it. One of the problems that is pronounced is that too often, once we get through it ourselves, we don't bother to look back and see who is struggling, see who is weak, see who is crippled by it. We assume the attitude of the teacher who just got his PhD, who will tell you in a minute, I got mine, get yours. You can't do it like that. We need to regain the sense of community that we used to have in Africa. We need to be responsible for each other in the kind of way that I grew up in a small town where that anybody, any adult that is to say, who saw you doing wrong, he'll whip your behind. As simple as that. And I think that that made a great deal of difference. But here, everyone is concerned for himself. We're not concerned for each other. Obviously, the answer is that we must develop the love and the concern and the sense of responsibility for others that we have developed for ourselves.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Fine.
Okay. Greg Comedy, a graduate student, will address the panel at this time.
Hello. I'm a first-year graduate student in history, and I'm very excited about the field. I'm definitely excited after seeing Daughters of the Dust by Julie Dash, and I think that's where my question is coming from. But it's going to be related to George Washington Williams, W.B. Du Bois, and others during the time period. African Americans have, in our aspiring to become a part of America, we have drawn on many different, ideologies and philosophies. How much has our African cultural values had to play in the struggle for, let me ask the question in a different way. I would like to know how much influence has African culture played in our liberation struggle in this country?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. I thought I understood you until the very last sentence. In our liberation struggle?
In the context, in Daughters of the Dust, there was a struggle.
I have not seen it.
Okay. All right. Let me ask it in a different way. W.E. Du Bois, I remember reading when he came back from Germany, and he was wearing European dress, and I read an essay about him saying that he was trying to move into the standard, I guess, European lifestyle and be accepted in the academy. And he had a battle that he was undergoing versus African culture, African-American culture, and moving into European culture. And I would like to know, for us, and looking at George Washington Williams and his aspirations to prove himself as a man, what, in the context of culture, did he use to prove that? What was the value system, going back to your statement about values, value system that African-Americans during the time period of George Washington Williams drew from to prove who they were, to prove their humanity?
Let me just say this, that it's my view that when Du Bois came from Berlin and was not accepted, it wasn't because he had on spats or that he had on, you know, a white starched collar and all of the trappings of Europe. It was because he was black. If I may say so, if he had on a dashiki in 1895 or 96, he wouldn't have been accepted either. He would come closer to being accepted now for reasons which I think you understand for what's happened in Africa. I don't want us to confuse the external trappings with the internal values, whatever they are. I think that that one mustn't dwell on those things so much as one dwells on these inner things, the things that Eric was talking about, the sense of family, family responsibility, the extended family, which certainly was central to the African community. All of those things, those are the things we ought to be preserving. I couldn't care less whether one, you know, has on a Rolex watch or T-Max watch, depending on what he can afford. But I do care whether he believes that his children should know that they come from a great heritage, and that a part of his heritage is the sense of responsibility, sense of community, sense of fairness, sense of justice, sense of selflessness, etc. And they ought to know, as I hinted at earlier, they ought to know that when Thomas Jefferson and all that crowd in 1776 started running off one direction, it was blacks. Blacks who said, now wait a minute, you can't be running around here talking about independence and freedom and hold us in slavery. You are so inconsistent, you can't even see the nose at the end of your face. You can't, you know, they were the ones who called up their logic and said, no, you can't do this. We need to know that. We need to know what we have done. And this country is not Europe altogether. This country is Africa. This country is now Latin America. It's all of it. And you don't go to the other extreme either, saying it's all Africa. That's silly too, you see. Just remember that we're all in this together, and we've all been a part of it for all these years, and that these external things are not nearly as important as these very internal, very important, deep-seated things, traditions and hopes and aspirations that we have as a people. And that's what we need to emphasize to our children. And that's what we need to emphasize to white people, too.
Thank you very much. We have time at least for one other question. This thing does not have to be eternal in order to be immortal. So in the interest of our panelists, and you've been such a beautiful audience, we will have at least time for one more question, because We have another activity, that is a book signing party across the street, and you will get a chance to speak personally with our panelists and purchase a book and let them autograph it. But we will have one more question. Yes.
My name is Charles Morris. I'm a year away from graduation at the ITC. My future plans include applying this year for the doctorate degree in the history of the Christian Church at Duke University. And I'd like to talk with both of you after I'm finished. I have specific questions for each of you, simply because two of you are my mentors and teachers, and the other two are my heroes in the field, I would say. And so I know what it means to be standing on the shoulder of giants, so to speak. First of all, Dr. Franklin, I'm so elated that you did the history on Brother Williams. I want to know, how do you see yourself in the scheme of things? All the history that you've chronicled, all the world traveling you've done just to get this bit of research that made a complete whole of what you're to do, and to write this book at this time is so significant in our history as historians, I think. That's my question for you. For Dr. Grant, could you speak to us, a young lady asked a question earlier about the appropriation or how can we incorporate the culture. Could you speak to us just briefly on how we do incorporate some of the African traditional religion belief systems into Christianity, and particularly womanist theology? And Dr. Lincoln, I would like just a brief update from you on what do you see the status of the Black Muslim movement here in the United States, if you would, with Savior's Day coming up on Sunday.
We'll begin with Dr. Lincoln, if it's okay. He wants to know the status of the Black Muslim.
I know what he wants.
I wanted to make sure you heard.
I want to know why you have to reverse the order. First of all, I think that this is a very good time to say that there are no Black Muslims in the United States. There used to be. I'm very serious about that. When I first began studying the Nation of Islam 30 years ago, I coined the phrase Black Muslims, and I coined it in an attempt to distinguish the particular group of people whom I was studying. But Islam has transcended that coinage, and it's really no longer proper to refer to anyone as a Black Muslim, because Islam has moved on so far and so rapidly from where it was at that point. To be brief about to be brief and to the point, what the old Black Muslims did under Elijah Muhammad was to really make America aware of an alternative religion. We had all been Christians, Protestants and Catholics, and Jews up to that point. And really, for 99% of the people who lived in America, there was no concept of any religion beyond Christianity and Judaism. Elijah Muhammad and his followers made us aware of another world religion, Islam. The question is not whether or not there was an issue of orthodoxy, but we had not therefore been accustomed to even thinking in terms of another religion. So in the sense that the old Black Muslims made us aware of one of the world's greatest living religions, then we benefited by that. But we have moved on from there to here. 2 years ago, in February 1990, I think it was, New York Times and Time Magazine both ran articles to the effect that Islam has now become the second largest religion in the country in terms of numbers, that it has eclipsed Judaism, and that you now have Christianity and Islam and Judaism. Now, that is extremely important. It's important in the sense that this society is changing, and is changing so rapidly. Particularly is it changing its religious configuration. Until now, it is not unusual at all to see a mosque right down the street from the church and so on. Atlanta has several, as a matter of fact. As a matter of fact, sitting behind you there is my associate, Dr. Lawrence Mamiya. He has a whole crew of people in here studying Islam at this very moment. So then, Islam is here. They just built a huge mosque right down the street from the United Nations recently. Islam is the fastest growing religion in this country, and it is also a religion that is claiming many blacks who used to be Christians, if you're interested in that. It is a religion we find now that has been around in this country much longer than we thought it had. When I first began researching Islam 30 years ago, it was very, very difficult to find any documentation as to the number of Muslims who have been slaves, et cetera, et cetera. But in the 30 years since then, scholarship has led us to understand that at least a quarter of the slaves who were brought here were Muslim, and perhaps more than that. And of course, we know that there were many, many Muslims with the Spanish conquistadors. So the whole point is that I'm trying to say is prepare, if you will, for the realization of a new world religion right beside Christianity. The United Presbyterians, as early as 1985, I think, commissioned a study to see how rapidly Islam was growing in this country so that they would be prepared to meet it. And they appointed about 20 scholars to study the growth of Islam. I happen to have been one of them, and they found out it was growing very rapidly. Indeed. I would sum up by saying that Islam is no longer an exotic religion. It is almost as common as, well, not as common as baptism and Methodism, but it's very close to it. You've probably got more Muslims than you have several of our major denominations. And there will be more and more and more.
Okay, in the next 7 minutes we have left, you need to rephrase the question, or do you remember? You've got it.
I have it. Let me just make three brief statements with regard to the question about the impact of African culture upon Christianity. One, just let me say that there are scholars who have begun to project arguments regarding the origin of Christianity, placing that on the continent of Africa. The whole era of Egyptology helps us to raise some new and different questions, actually some not so new questions, about Christianity and its origin. I think we still have yet to see what the end will be in terms of that area of studies. Secondly, there are many African theologians these days who have begun to, who have rejected the traditional imperialistic supremacist understanding of Christianity, and who have begun to see African traditional religions as not merely a stepping stone toward the real religion, which is Christianity, but who, in fact, though affirming their Christianity, argue that African traditional religions represents a valid source in the doing of theology, and so they've begun to do a different kind of Christian theology, affirming the African heritage, African culture, African traditional religions, as opposed to the old missionary style of negating and deculturalizing the African context. So you have that new breed of African theologians that have emerged on the scene. And thirdly, regarding womanist theology, womanist theology is at its embryonic stages. There is so much to be done in that area. As I indicated earlier, we are in need of women, African-American women, in all of the disciplines, all of the theological disciplines, religious studies. And so I think the future will really tell where we are, where we will end up on those, that and other questions. But I think that one of the very basic linkage has to do with our understanding of the connectedness of life, kind of like some of the issues that Sarah talked about earlier, and also John Hope talked about earlier, in terms of some of the values that we bring to the theological table. I think womanist theologians in general affirm those basic African-American values. Yes.
Yeah, I might add.
We just reject sexism.
Right, exactly.
And some other things.
Franklin, we don't have 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, how do I see myself? Primarily as a teacher. I've always regarded myself as a teacher. And after 56 years of it, I could be nothing else. I teach in various ways. I teach with my students in front of me when I have any. I've just entered my third retirement, I should say, so that I won't have any more students sitting out in front of me. And one of the reasons I quit was that my larger student group, that is the reading public, needs to hear a few more things from me. And that's why I have quit the classroom and will continue to teach in these various forms. Writing, a tiny bit of lecturing, and some documentary and broadcast work, such as I should be doing this weekend in New York City. And so carrying the message forward is what I want to do and what I have been doing. And I pledge to continue to do. So,
you've done a great job.
Thank you. Let's get it. I would like to ask in the next few minutes we have left, is Charles Jones in the audience? If not, is Reverend Philip Dunstan in the audience? Remain standing, Phil. You see the prints in the rear of us here. To my right is George Washington Williams. And in the middle is the theologian, African Methodist Episcopal minister, Jerina Lee, date born in 1783. And on this side, we have the eminent sociologist, E. Franklin Frazier. And these prints were done by one of our students who is an artist under the supervision of Christopher Hickey. And we would just like to thank Charles Jones and also Philip Dunstan for coordinating this for us. Let's give them a hand. We are very privileged to have all of you. All of you are very important. We have distinguished visitors with us. Dr. William Turner from Winston-Salem State University. Would you stand? We have Dr. William B. McLean, professor of homiletics and liturgy, Wesley Seminary. And we have Dr. Lawrence Nemea, professor and head of the African Religious Studies, distinguished professor at Vassar College. And we have someone, I think, here from Morehouse College.
No, Andrew Billingsley.
Dr. Billingsley from Spelman College, our sister school.
And the University of Maryland.
And the University of Maryland. We're so delighted to have you. All of you are very important, and we have had a marvelous forum. We thank you for your participation. We thank you for sharing with us. This has been a marvelous day, and the day is really not over because we do have a book signing party directly across the street at Soul Source Bookstore. You will have an opportunity to collaborate with our panelists, and we just thank you. Actually, because of your cooperation and your support, you have made it very easy on the Department of Religion and Philosophy in cooperation with the School of Arts and Sciences in this wonderful 10th anniversary of the Cyric Lincoln Lectureship. You are certainly our community. We love you. You're great people. And as we leave, remember, together we stick, and divided we're stuck. God bless you. We'll go directly across the street to the Soul Source Bookstore now, please. Thank you so much.
Children were caught in the crossfire of violent crime. How much longer will you let this go on? Call this number now. We'll send you information on how you can protect your children from crime in your neighborhood. Together, we will take a bite out of crime.
Hi, I'm Mickey Howard, and you're watching CAU TV, Cable Channel 3, Clark Atlanta University.